When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
After dumping Reed Rednar at the Pearl and Rose, Bryce calls on her friends to party at the White Raven in order to avoid confronting Connor's intensity at home. While a night of drugs and dancing brings Bryce to life, little does she know what she is about to return home to find. With Danica and the pack of devils dead, only one tenuous thread keeps Bryce safely in the witness column and not the alternative. The views expressed by the hosts are entirely their own and in no way represent the thoughts or intentions of the original author.
This podcast is a discussion shared to spark thought and conversation on the characters and themes of this novel.
The interpretations presented in this podcast are just a few of the many possibilities. Listeners are encouraged to read along and share their own analysis of the text.
Though the hosts speak mostly within the constraints of this book, series and extended universe spoilers may be discussed with or without warning.
Explicit language, as well as themes of sex, violence, abuse, depression, self-harm, and death will recur throughout this podcast. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to Book Talk for Book Talk, a podcast where we deep dive into the writing of your favorite novels.
This season, we're exploring Sarah J. Maas's first installment in the Crescent City series. This is Jack.
And I'm Amy. This week, we're discussing chapters 4-7 in House of Earth and Blood.
This week, we ask ourselves, what are the early false perceptions of Bryce?
Themes we see in this section include the absence of friendship.
This is part one of this week's episode. Stick around for part two, which releases on Thursday.
So I'm really excited to talk about all the different displays of power in chapter four. First, let's start with the setting. We find Bryce in the Pearl and Rose. It has a bronze door, there are crystal chandeliers, and I'm sure it's extra, extra gaudy, but I just want to point out the things that look like materially expensive. By comparison, Bryce isn't dressed up for this level of fancy. Remember from last week, Bryce has blowjob red lipstick and a very revealing dress. The restaurant, on the other hand, screams class, while Bryce screams crass.
Ayy. I would be like, well, Bryce screams blowjobs.
Also that. Quote, the upper echelons of Crescent City were entertaining themselves by sneering at her dress, the skin on display, the fey ears, but clearly human body. The physical location and the people surrounding Bryce create a sense of smallness for her, and it's going to drive her to find comfort somewhere she feels like she belongs, which is the White Raven.
I love that Bryce is seated in the center of the room, quote, in the heart of the gilded dining room, because as predators versus prey go, that's the worst place that any prey could sit in, is in the middle of everything. And who chose to sit there? Reed, the dumbass human. I'm going to be making a case that humanity will represent the feminine. And because, and I, again, hate saying this, but in this case, you know, feminine is weak, humans are weak, but I'm going to say feminine is going to be weaponized and then it's actually going to be strong. It's going to be a journey, guys. Stick with me.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyone who's listened to ACOTAR seasons is like,
we know.
I know. But I'm like worried for the new ones where I'm like, this is going to sound crazy, but hear me out. It's going to get relatively decent.
Well, you at least have me for the ride. I have no choice.
Isn't that the theme of our friendship?
Yeah.
You have no choice. I'm going to be making the case that human is going to represent the feminine, and I've already started in the last episode saying that Bryce's curvy body has been pointed out to be human and how she has the wrong body type. Also, what if this is like, as I was typing, I had like this tangent of thoughts. I was like, what if the wrong body type doesn't mean curvy? Because like here in the real world, in our world, you know, ballerinas are super thin. Mm-hmm. What if like it's not just curvy, but it's the fact that it's human, therefore not as strong, you know, where it's like your body isn't fey, your body's human. It won't be able to be as durable as the rest of ours.
No, that's a great point, because we make assumptions on what wrong body type means. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it is the curvy thing, but I wanted to throw in another option.
No, I mean, it could be both.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Mm. Basically, humans mean weakness, and Bryce's human body is the ultimate feminine. Therefore, Bryce is the ultimate weak, both socially, physically, and just overall everything. And this restaurant points all of it out, but Bryce wants it to be pointed out. She wants to look different and flaunt her humanity. She's here for the spectacle. Otherwise, she would have dressed differently.
Absolutely.
Like, she made a choice.
She knew she was putting on blowjob red lipstick.
And a short-ass dress. Like, she still shouldn't be judged for it at all, but she's coming for the drama.
That's right.
They aren't just, like, judging her for her dress, though. Quote, the skin on display, the fey ears, but clearly human body, half-breed, she could nearly hear. They considered her a lowly worker at best, prey and dumpster fodder at worst.
I mean, talk about power right there. In this sentence, human equals prey.
Yeah. The power dynamic is like, Sarah's just like, here you are.
Yeah. This is what I mean.
This is, yeah, everything. So I think you're going to like this note that I have next. I love when Sarah J. Maas does this, when we kind of bookend something. So the beginning of the night is in many ways like Bryce walking up the three steps to the restaurant. Mm-hmm. Is the beginning of her night. Like, I know she was at the apartment and she was getting ready, but like that kind of marks the start of the night. And she walks up the three steps and they are the bronze doors. The end of the night, when she goes home, she has to walk up three flights of steps to her door that is covered in blood that she describes as coppery. Mm. And bronze and copper aren't the same, obviously, but the imagery and the look of it is still there.
Yeah, good call.
Thank you.
Nice job.
Thank you.
So let's talk more from a power perspective. Reed is late. And this isn't just a male thing. Let's view this as a power thing. Like when the coworker you don't like shows up late to the meeting because they know it's going to piss you off. It's that sort of late. Quote, 45 minutes without a call or message to tell her he'd be late. It's such a power play, and it shows how little respect Reed has for Bryce. I'm sure also having her there waiting for him makes him feel like others will see him as more powerful, right? Because she's not on hand on foot waiting for him, but she's at his beck and call.
I hate those power moves. I hate it. I've had bosses before in the past that show up 15 minutes late to a meeting, and I'm just sitting there on Zoom. Like, what are you going to do, bro? Like, what are we doing here? Why are we here?
Yeah. Yeah.
I immediately go for like college rules. Mm-hmm. You're not here. I'm out.
Yeah. No, I mean, honestly, and with the day of Zoom,
yeah,
if you're not there within the first 5 minutes and I have no message from you, I'm gone.
Absolutely. I also absolutely hate when people are late. Like, I can be late, and I know that. I was late last night. But, I mean, in LA, you have to be understanding of traffic. But it's the people who are like, you just know they're always going
to
be late.
Right. And it's one thing to be 15 minutes late because of traffic. It's another thing to be 45 minutes late or more.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-mm.
So Reed doesn't even have the decency to pay attention to Bryce once he actually does arrive. Quote, Reed shrugged, scanning the restaurant for high-ranking officials to hobnob with. And when Reed doesn't find anybody, he pays attention only to the menu or his phone. Multiple times, he looks at Bryce and frowns or shakes his head in disapproving ways, like when Bryce gets a text message, even though he's on his phone the whole freaking time. He is on his phone. She gets a text message and he's like, mm-mm, not okay.
No.
Because somehow Reed has the right to be on his phone and Bryce does not.
It is double standard. It is scolding father energy. We don't want father energy. We want daddy energy.
That's right.
That's right. We are here for daddies. And daddies only.
No fathers.
No.
Like the environment, Reed is making Bryce feel insignificant, reminding her that she is other. Even though Reed is human, like Bryce is, kind of, Reed's family is one of the few families to be successful among Vanir, and he likes to act like he belongs among them. The irony is that, like Bryce, Reed works with a personal trainer not for vanity's sake, but to make sure his, quote, body was primed for when its strength might be needed to escape any would-be predators hunting the streets. So, in the back of his mind, Reed knows his place, but he tries to use money and power plays like the one we're seeing with Bryce right now to make it look like Reed's not afraid of what it means to be the prey among a room full of predators.
I don't know if I could live in a world where I have to know how to run to survive.
It's not knowing how to run. It's being capable of running.
Yeah. I'm not ready for that world. I'll take the Vespa because she has like a little scooter.
Yeah. It's a good choice.
Yeah. Hold on before you attack me. Let me unlock. I'm out of gas, so please don't go too far. Reed and Bryce are really similar in other ways as well. Just like Bryce, Reed takes a lot of time on how he looks. Quote, Reed was meticulous about his appearance, down to the very last detail. Every tie he'd worn, she'd learn, was selected to bring out the green in his hazel eyes. His suits were always impeccably cut to his toned body. She might even have called him vain, had she not put such consideration in her own outfits. Bryce recognizes herself in him, that they're both peacocking. And I wonder how much of this is because they're both human and that they know in order to survive, they have to be worth more in so many ways, including their looks. Mm-hmm, you know, like someone's more willing to kill the ugly human than the hot human.
Probably, honestly, if you don't look like you take the time to take care of yourself, you must not be important. Therefore, it's easy to attack you.
Yeah.
Because you're more likely to be forgotten.
Yeah. Like, you know, putting on a good show.
Yeah.
Makes someone want to stop a little bit in their tracks and be like, are you worth killing?
Right.
This Vanir world is pretty harsh.
Yeah, it's got a lot of layers.
Yeah. There's also a food versus slaves concept here, and Bryce is going to make a number of comments about humans and half-humans being forced to, quote, whore themselves to Vanir, and we're going to get that imagery time and time again. Another thing is that this is kind of painting it in the negative, that Reed is shit. We know that, right? He shows up late. We don't like him. So we know that this is meant to be viewed in a negative light, mm-hmm. even though Bryce is the one who also does this. But again, it's different because he's a man and it's showing that he is human because he has to rely on his looks. Mm-hmm. Therefore, he is not protector. He is not predator. He is a weak human. And it's also like such a stark contrast to when we see Hunt later, who's Mr. Backwards baseball cap. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't care about his image at all. He doesn't have to because he's the ultimate predator.
Right. He is the strongest even among his kind in mm-hmm. a lot of ways. So yeah, he doesn't have to give a shit about what he looks like.
Do you think I can accomplish that? Be the strongest in something?
Yes, absolutely.
And I won't care. I'm too vain.
I think you would always care.
I will always care.
Because it's easier to get compliments about how good you are when you already look good. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's actually a very insightful thing. Yes.
Just my personal opinion on
life. Wow. Look at you.
So Reed is the one that's been doing all these power plays. Bryce reacts in a way to claim back her power. And what she does is retaliates by drinking a bottle of very, very expensive wine that will cost her, if Reed doesn't show up to 2 months worth of dance classes, which she loves, which, you know, is a huge risk on Bryce's part, in my opinion. However, this move doesn't even faze Reed by the time he actually shows up. He just looks at the empty bottle or almost empty bottle and says, good choice.
I always read that as like a sarcastic nice choice.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like, I don't even think he meant it.
Oh, like, he's like, oh, you could have done better?
Yeah, like, I thought it was kind of like a nice choice.
Oh, well.
I guess
we'll wait until the graphic audio and that we'll get the interpretation.
Right?
At the end of the day, it's my opinion that Bryce doesn't really have any power to wield here, even though she tries. ultimately, she's the only one impacted by the choice of wine. Reed is not. He can be sarcastic about it, but he can afford it regardless of what she chooses. She can't. We see this again when Reed signals for Bryce to stop staring at the fey and human couple next to them. And she retaliates by ordering another bottle of expensive wine. It doesn't bother Reed, regardless of what Bryce tries to do. Similarly, only Bryce is impacted by the choice of food. Reed is not. In fact, Reed just continues to work on his phone and says, go ahead and eat it.
It just reminds me of like one time when I first started working in the workforce. I was, for whatever reason, I went across the street, went to this wine shop, and I bought myself a really nice bottle of wine. And I was like, I'm going to save this for a really good moment. Like, this is an expensive bottle of wine. Mm-hmm. You know the story.
I know the story.
I think like not a decade passed, but like a long time passes. And I went, I was like with you, and I'm like, I have this really nice bottle of wine that I bought forever ago. I spent a bunch of money on it, and I looked it up, and it was $30. Not that that's cheap, but
at the time,
I was so broke that like, I was like, this is the, like, the most I will ever spend on wine. I mean, it's still more than I would spend on mine on wine now, but.
Yeah, I love me a $7 bottle from Trader Joe's.
Question to you. When I read about the human male and the fae female and how he's just a plaything and how he's super high, I kind of saw it as a mirror to Bryce. And I think she half recognizes that it's a mirror. I think that she sees herself in that human being stuck at dinner as a plaything. Reed is not fae. We've, you know, made a point that he's obviously human, but it's not dissimilar that she's sitting there for for food. And she says later on, like, I'm here in exchange for shitty sex.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're completely right. Regardless of whether or not Reed is equivalent to fae in her mind, I could see Bryce looking at the human across from her and thinking, wow, that could be me if I was really desperate.
And then it's almost like, shit.
Yeah.
I kind of am really desperate.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Like, I don't have to be this desperate.
Yeah, I think that's part of the reason why she goes over to that fae female.
Yes.
Also, just to kind of be like, no, I'm not like this person.
I agree.
And good for you, Bryce.
Yeah.
Good for you. Get up and walk away. We do not accept mediocre sex, but more importantly, we don't accept small portion sizes.
Absolutely not. You must be a full human.
Not in this household. Also, side note, as a reminder, I just kind of find this, like, every once in a while, this fact would pop into my head throughout this episode because she gets called a whore a lot. Mm-hmm. Now, what makes a whore? Slut is a social construct, blah, all that stuff. There's no such thing as a slut. I believe that. But like, keep in mind, she's only slept with this guy twice and they've been together for 2 months.
Right.
That's nothing.
Especially for Bryce. She's willing to hook up with people in the bathroom at the White Raven. Like, that's
like, but it also just kind of shows that maybe hooking up in the bathroom at the White Raven isn't her norm. You know?
That's a great point.
Because I will make a case later that it's like, well, that's a little assaulty. Like, is she able to consent? Mm-hmm. You know, I know the text seemed like she was like, I just want to take the edge off. But here we are. We have evidence of how she behaved for 2 months. And that is, she was monogamous with a person and only had sex twice. Like, and if they had sex recently, that means she went a month or so without having sex with someone. And that's like, that's hard.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
I think you make a great point. I never was cognizant of, oh, if her norm is to date someone and not have sex regularly, granted, he's not great, but
yeah,
I think that's meaningful.
I thought so. So it's just always like a interesting note. And remember how I mentioned last episode, Bryce feminizing weapons and everything? Here's just one of those beautiful moments. And in this case, she's actually weaponizing the feminine. Quote, Bryce tapped a red nail on the base of her wine glass. She kept her nails long, and she took a daily elixir to keep them strong. Not as effective as talons or claws, but they could do some damage.
You said to me last night, like, I'm going to be Bryce and keep my nails red.
And that is from this passage. Exactly. Yeah. We'll see how long that I can keep that up.
So there's a lot of tension brewing right now. Bryce is annoyed with Reed. She's annoyed with the fae next to her. She sees herself in the human across from her. So all of this comes to a head when the fae noblewoman across from Bryce and Reed sneers at Bryce for merely acknowledging her. For like a, like, no words, just like a head bob, like, hey there.
Sup.
Sup. The human man, Reed, in front of Bryce is not treating Bryce like an equal. On top of that, the fae female across from Bryce isn't treating Bryce like an equal. Bryce doesn't belong to either side here. She is neither in the good graces of the human nor in the good graces of the fae. And so she's powerless in face of their treatment. And what happens? She snaps. Let's not forget that throughout all of this, both Connor and Danica are pressuring Bryce into dating Connor via text. Bryce is literally being assaulted on all sides, from her friends in text, from the people around her. It doesn't matter if Bryce is into Connor. Bryce has been avoiding entangling herself with him for the last 5 years. It was her choice how she wanted to control that relationship, and that control is being jeopardized. It makes complete sense to me then that Bryce does things that make her feel like she's taking back her power. What are those things? She breaks up with Reed, which needed to happen anyway. She steals the wine from the table and takes it out of the restaurant, even though it's like half full. She insults the fae noble about her sexual ability and frugality. She makes a pass at the fae noble's human toy just for funsies. And let's not forget, she also steals some of the free matchbooks at the host stand on her way out. Just because she can.
As someone who's tried to walk out with a bottle of wine, they do stop you.
They do stop you.
You know, I mean, granted, this is America. This is Crescent City.
Yeah, maybe Crescent City, they allow alcohol on the streets like they do in Las Vegas.
Yeah, I absolutely was stopped. And I threw my mom under the bus and said she wanted it and ducked out.
I've definitely taken alcohol, put it in my purse, and just walked out with it.
Many times. I tried doing that too. And then I was like, someone came over and was like, we saw you. Like,
yeah.
Why do you care? Leave me alone.
Right.
Let me do my thing. I'm not driving. Danica and Connor's texts drive me up the fucking wall. And what I wrote here was, it stands out to me. But no, what it does, it pisses me off. And as you said, Bryce is getting attacked in every direction. And it's so annoying because, like, so many things about this night could have been avoided. And Bryce is such a victim to everything around her. Like, she really, I mean, she could put her foot down in so many places, sure. But, like, everyone else is doing things to her this night.
And she's 23.
And she's like, 23.
It's hard to set boundaries at that age.
Absolutely. Gives the 20-year-old some grace. They are our biggest demographic.
Oh, thanks, 23-year-olds.
Just 20s. I don't know the specific age. All you 20s. Okay, so I know the text might seem harmless, but, you know, we're here to do analysis, which means we're going to dig into it. So, like, you know, let me have this. Let's start with Connor's text. Quote, "You know I'm shit with talking." It's my Connor voice. "You know I'm shit with talking. But I wanted to say, before you tried to get into a fight with me instead, by the way, was I think it's worth it." All right. So was Bryce trying to get into a fight with Connor at the apartment? Maybe. Or maybe she was trying to not have a conversation with someone that she knows what's about to happen. And she's trying to do that in a way that's not awkward.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I just, the whole, like, that you tried to start a fight with me, by the way, like, shut up. If I want to start a fight, I will.
Right.
You'll know.
Right.
You'll know when this fight has started.
Sorry, I challenged you.
That's what it is. That's what it freaking is. All she did was challenge him. And It was like, you're trying to start a fight with me, by the way. Little bitch ass pup. No.
Good thing he dies.
I almost wrote that in my notes. I was like, so long, Connor. No regrets here. I understand that this is supposed to show, like, that a guy is willing to call her on her shit and all this stuff. But, like, you know, I want to remind people that it's showing a guy who's willing to ignore her side of the conversations and where her actions were coming from. What gets to Bryce, though, is the him saying, "I'm crazy about you," and the reminder that he and Danica both, quote, rip into the stupid assholes who hiss slurs at her or mistook her for one of the many half-veneer females who sold their bodies. Like, he's been the protector before. And, you know, she likes the protector. Why? Because at the end of the day, Connor is veneer. The masculine, aka daddy issues, like her dad, who's a veneer. She specifically stays away from veneer because they remind her of her dad, who was an alpha hole to her mom. But in this moment at the dinner, when Bryce feels defenseless and unwanted, what better moment than to give into your daddy issues? Right? Mm-hmm. It just, yeah. It all makes sense.
Why not?
Now to go into Danica's text. Quote, a date with him won't kill you. He's been waiting years, Bryce, years. Give me something to smile about tonight. The command there, the telling Bryce what to do, and people might hate me saying this, but it's emotional manipulation too.
100%.
Do this to make me happy. It's not once, Amy, have you ever said, hey, go sleep with Theo James to make me happy. And I'm just saying you can try harder. I know he's married and I respect that.
I respect that decision, but
I'm here. If you need me. Also, like, we learn later on that back in college, Danica ordered Connor to leave Bryce alone until, like, Bryce goes up to him. Mm-hmm. And Bryce is like, oh, I guess Danica must have, like, let off on those orders. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just like she has, you don't have a hand in someone's romantic life like that.
Yeah.
Stop it.
Yeah.
We don't do that.
Yeah. I mean, again, this group do not understand healthy boundaries.
20s.
It's yeah, a chronic problem with all 20-year-olds. And had they lived, maybe they would have figured it out. Maybe they wouldn't have. Mm-hmm. But doesn't mean it's okay.
No.
So at this point in the night, if I was Bryce, I think I would just go home. There is pizza waiting on the counter for me.
There's no world where I choose to go out.
No, absolutely not.
She already said that she barely put an effort to get ready.
Right, right.
You're not losing anything.
Right, exactly, exactly. You didn't spend an hour on your hair and makeup or 2 hours on your hair and makeup.
No.
It's worth it to go home.
Yes.
But no. That's where Connor and Danica, who are trying to tell Bryce what to do, are located. And Bryce wants to feel like she's the one in control because she's just left a situation where she wasn't in control. So why not avoid the problem and seek solace in places and vices where Bryce feels powerful? Literally, the quote reads, quote, the White Raven was only a 5-minute walk away, right in the heart of the old square, which left Bryce with enough time to either really truly get into trouble or face what she'd been avoiding for an hour now. She opted for trouble. Like, SJM is just calling it out for us constantly.
There were times in my 20s, and again, I'm specifying 20s because, again, in my 30s, I was just too tired. But there were times that I, like, would think, I'm going to make a bad choice right now. Mm. And I was so clear and knew exactly the moment it was. Normally involved an ex or something else. But, like, it was just those moments of, like, no, I'm going to make the wrong choice today.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we all have those. You know what? The moral of the story, everyone, is that at times in your life, you're going to want to feel in control. And yeah. Growing up is about finding the healthy ways of feeling in control.
Right. Right. And not giving in to the impulses that make you falsely feel like you're in power.
Because that was one of the first things I had to learn was the, like, me feeling control was me making bad choices on my terms.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I had to, like, let that go. Be like, yeah. All right, let's start making good choices on my terms.
Right. I we're all that way. This bad thing happened to me, so let me choose to make something different bad happen to me.
Right? Yeah.
At least I have control over that bad.
Over that bad. I chose that bad.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. By the way, none of Bryce's situation is helped by the fact that both Fury and Juniper know instantly that Bryce has dumped Reed without Bryce even being able to share that news herself. Like, again, her power is being taken away from her.
Mm-hmm.
It just continues to push Bryce over the edge.
Bryce also tries to justify it. She compares Danica telling their friends about her crap date to, like, when she asked Connor, hey, is Danica okay after the meeting with Briggs? That's not the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
That is totally different. And, like, I understand what Danica is doing. What makes me more mad is Juniper and Fury. That's my issues with them, because I get friends wanting to give heads up. What, you just keep your fucking mouth shut.
Then. You pretend you haven't been informed.
Yeah, you just kind of keep it shut. Of like, all right. And then you just know, like, follow their lead. Do we want to talk about it? Do we not want to talk about it? What I'm not going to do is have that be the very first thing I say to you.
Right.
That's such a bad friend move.
It is. They could have just been like, hey, I thought you were on a date tonight. And then Bryce could be like, oh, well, I dumped him.
So then boom, something.
Exactly.
Anything. Yeah, that's on Danica. I mean, like, that's on Juniper and Fury.
Yeah, no, you're right.
They're busy probably hooking up. That was kind of my theory.
I actually don't know that they're together at this point.
Because Juniper goes and hooks up with a guy.
She goes and dances with a guy.
All it says disappear for 10 minutes.
True. I feel like Fury would be possessive, though.
If they're together.
Right.
But at one point, Fury disappears.
Yeah, okay. We don't need to speculate.
We don't need to speculate, no. On these very real lives of very real people.
So I love this line, and I had to bring it up. It's when Bryce views the line outside the White Raven. Quote, Vanir peered up in anticipation at the white marble facade, well-dressed pilgrims waiting at the gates of a temple. I love this because partying is a religion, drugs are the sacrament, and like Bryce, her friends, the people who go to the White Raven, either they are the gods or they're there to worship their gods of partying. And you can see what type of people are there. And it's just really, I thought it was a really well-written sentence.
It's a great sentence. It's visceral. You can be there. You can feel it. You know the energy that's there. You know, everyone is like, you know, kind of has that sexual nature that's about to come, that you're about to see in the next chapter. But I do love that line. The other line I really like is when there was a group of mountain lion shifters who looked over and growled in interest. And then I spent the next several minutes going like, like, what's growling in interest? Hey,
I want to also point out an angst moment that I had while reading this chapter. If Danica wasn't so loyal to the Pack of Devils, she may have joined Bryce at the club and she may have lived. And if Bryce had told Connor, like, hey, I'm feeling frisky right now, why don't you meet me at the club? He might have lived too. And I see all these moments as I read this first part of the novel thinking, wow, if Bryce had made one change, things could have been different. And I'm sure that's an experience Bryce has to live through, right? Of just replaying every moment of like, I could have done this, I could have done this, and they could have lived. And that brought me a lot of inner turmoil for her.
Oh, absolutely. And especially since this doesn't seem like any different night than any other night.
Exactly.
And that's what makes it also hard, where, like you're saying, could have done something different, would have done something different. You know, you could say the would have, could have, should have.
If I only played it safe.
Some more
Except
Taylor
she
Swift.
Wasn't playing it safe.
I know, she didn't play it safe. I mean, but if she played it safe, she would have died.
True.
Honestly, if Danica had just been like, hey, Pack of Devils, how about we all go partying together?
Right, instead of watching
this movie.
Yeah.
But again, I think Danica knew she was going to die. So
maybe she just, yeah, who knows? Before we move on to the next chapter, Fury mentions that Bryce hardly put on any makeup for the date. From the perspective of power, I know I personally talk about makeup being battle armor. If we view makeup in this case as battle armor, Bryce was unprepared for the battle at dinner with Reed, and that's why she's at the White Raven right now. And it's just sad because she'll also be unprepared for what's about to happen next.
Dun, dun, dun. Let's go into chapter 5.
So instead of going home, Bryce retreats to the inner sanctum of the White Raven. It's an interesting choice of words, inner sanctum. The word choice implies privacy, sacredness, and though the White Raven isn't actually private, this certainly is a sacred place for Bryce, where she worships whatever higher power allows her to live the life of a party girl. quote, life was fucking good, and she couldn't goddamn wait to make the drop with Danica and do this until the earth crumbled to dust. How does Bryce worship? Through drugs and dance. We especially get to see Bryce dance and how important dancing and music is to her. Like we talked about last week, this is all so that when Bryce chooses to deprive herself of these things, we feel how significant that loss is. Quote, Bryce's blood pulsed in time to the music, as if she had been crafted just for this, the moment when she became the notes and the rhythm and the bass, when she became song-given form. Like their bodies were so full of sound, they could barely contain it, could barely stand it, and only dance could express it, ease it, honor it.
It's like, I don't want to experience it. No, I don't want to experience it.
What, that sensation?
Yeah. But no, like I do. No, I've, but I have. But we have.
Yeah, I've definitely felt that in my lifetime.
No, I have. I have. I'm just, it just requires so much effort now.
Yeah, I don't have. Yeah, I can't.
I just get the same feeling about Baked Brie now.
Mm-hmm.
That's where my temple is. No, I take it back. That's Taylor Swift concert.
Yeah.
I would like to say that this is Bryce leaning into her veneer side. Bryce is with two of her veneer friends, Fury, who is also doing drugs and is full veneer, although we don't know what kind. But we know that the drugs go through veneer systems faster than humans, and Bryce is half human, therefore is going through her system faster than Bryce. And right now, Bryce is trying to keep up with Fury, is getting far more stoned than she's ever been. Why are we not concerned about this?
No, that's a great point. Like, especially Danica's not here, but anytime that Bryce has had drugs with Danica, they were probably doing them at the same pace.
Yeah.
And Bryce's system does not metabolize them as quickly.
And for like Miss Fury here, who is like, you know, badass assassin going up with a knife to her throat saying like,
you'd be dead.
You'd be dead by now. It's just like, okay, well, what about if you both are unconscious?
Yeah.
You can't move because of all the drugs. Also, like, such bad friend code. When you're out with your friends, you do not let one go off.
No.
And slip away. Like, you're with them the entire night.
Yeah.
It's very bad. Someone should, Juniper, what were you doing? You're the sober one. You should have gone home with Bryce.
Yeah.
Fury can take care of herself. Someone should have gone home with Bryce and escorted her. Bad friends. I didn't realize how mad I am at them.
You're very mad,
I'm
apparently.
Very mad. I'm, you know what? I'm new stance. I'm not anti them. I'm just anti shitty friends.
Just better, you know, be better at being friends.
We're able to see a little more of how much it upsets Bryce. And then with Juniper, Bryce is dancing, right? She's able to lean into that whole sacred dancing and everything. And, you know, even kind of describes Juniper as a little exhibitionist. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. She's able to lean into her despite her body. And she keeps thinking about her having the wrong body type. And you can tell that that's been on her mind and it's bothering her a lot more. And we're able to see how much it upsets her. Bryce thinks about quitting her life and, quote, live in the club. They could hire her to dance in one of those steel cages dangling from the glass ceiling. They certainly wouldn't spew bullshit about her wrong body type. I want to say that there's nothing wrong with being a go-go dancer or any kind of erotic dancer, but we know that that wasn't Bryce's dream, right? She wanted to be a ballet dancer. And this is more than just erotic dancing. It's being kept in a steel cage.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're back to this idea of half veneer women, Faye, who are sex slaves, mm-hmm. being kept as prisoner. And she's like kind of leaning into it where she's like, at least you'll keep me. Yeah, as a prisoner, honey, like let's not go for the steel cages. In a moment when she's embracing the veneer side, embracing the recklessness, she's also putting herself back into the role of humans that the veneers once had them in as slaves.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept because Bryce ultimately, in that moment, is not afraid of the cage that she would put herself in because she's used to being caged.
Mm-hmm.
She's always been caged. So what does it matter to be in another cage?
Yeah.
It's a cage of her choosing.
Yeah. Versus thinking like, let's not do cages at
right,
all.
Right. Well, Easy for you to say, person who's never lived in a cage.
Grace has never lived in a cage.
I'm talking about metaphorical cages.
Okay, I was like, wait a minute. I live in the metaphorical cage that is the patriarchy.
That's okay, fair.
Thank you.
Fair. There is this undercurrent of uncertainty that's lurking in the background of this scene for me, and I want to call it out. While yes, the White Raven is literally the ruins of a temple, there is also some imagery to me that implies the foundation of Bryce's life is about to fall apart. So let me read a few quotes. Quote, their private booth sat between two half-crumbling pillars. Bryce also stumbles onto and across the dance floor on a regular basis, like she's on shaky legs. Bryce wants to live until, quote, the earth crumbled into dust. And then at some point late into the night or the early morning, quote, time slowed and bled. I'm going to choose to not leave this for the breadcrumbs because I'm speculating here and I think it's relevant. We know Danica and the Pack of Devils are in the process of being killed right now, hence the crumbling imagery. Bryce's life is crumbling and she doesn't even know it. Time slowing and bleeding reminds me when time warps when Micah and Sandriel are killed later in the novel. Now, I understand that they are archangels and that maybe that happens for a completely different reason related to the Asteri breeding that we're not aware of. However, what if the same phenomenon is taking place here because Danica's strength is equivalent to that of an archangel's and she is in the process of being killed? Just a thought. Or, you know, Bryce is just really fucking drunk and high, so the world is warping.
Look, is that the case? Probably, but I like what this is, what's happening here. Also, it kind of reminds me of, like, later on when Bryce goes after the demon monster thing, and she describes the room as almost pulsating.
Yep.
And, again, we've all been super stoned or drunk, so, like, I really understand this feeling. But let's lean into a little speculation.
Yeah, I think it could just be she's drunk and high, and those are the effects that she's feeling. Or in this moment, it could be because of Danica dying. Later on, when we talk about it, and I think I bring it up again, it could be like the adrenaline coursing through her veins, and it's just... Well,
we know the horns in her back.
Oh, yeah, that's also
true. You know, like, the horns in her back. It's only been in her back for like a day or two, right? This is the first time since she got the horn that she is super plastered.
Oh, maybe it's a side effect.
Rather than Danica's power, it could be the horn's power.
Oh.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, her not knowing that she's controlling it, but she's so high and drunk that she's controlling some horn power.
Could be. Who knows?
Who knows? SJM knows.
We don't.
She won't tell us.
I think SJM had a lot of fun writing this scene leading up to Bryce finding Danica and the Pack of Devils torn to pieces.
You're right. You're right. And I thought this entire time, and you're going to do such a great job summarizing it. But, like, I'm really excited because of, like, the writers in us see how fucked up this is.
Yeah, it is so fucked up. And in my brain, she's just cackling the entire time, like,
yep.
None of y'all know what's about to happen.
It's so in your face. So go ahead, tell us. Tell us, Amy.
So when Bryce gets home, but cannot get into her building, she's trying to figure out what her building code might be through her high. Quote, even if Bryce somehow managed to call Danica, her friend would rip her head off. So stab me in the heart, like, Danica can't rip your head off because her head's been ripped off. Sorry.
every single word through this entire thing is done cruelly on purpose.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's so much more cruel the second time you read it than the first time.
Yeah.
Then, as Bryce climbs the stairs in her building and she approaches her apartment, she complains many times about the stench. Quote, she scowled at the reek of the stairwell. Gods, it stunk. What did the people in this building eat? Or for that matter, who did they eat?
Like, that one makes me laugh so hard.
Yeah, it's bad.
That one is so bad.
Yeah,
in the best way possible.
Right, right. Because her friends have basically been eaten. And the smell is their carcasses.
It's great.
It's terrible. So I'm not done. Let's talk about the fact that Bryce thinks about how her feet hurt, like walk on glass hurt, because she's literally walking on glass right now. Bryce also steps in a cold puddle she thinks is caused by a dripping ceiling pipe. And nope, that's definitely blood. She's about to realize it. You don't exactly catch on as a first-time reader, but as a second-time reader, the dread I feel every time I read this section is insane. And like I said before, SJM's just laughing throughout all of it.
Oh, yeah. Like, even the line, quote, Bryce was never drinking again or polluting her bodies with those drugs ever again. Like, yeah, no, she becomes sober after this night. Like, everything that she says is true.
Yeah.
None of it is a metaphor. It's all true. And then there's this line, quote, she debated sleeping on the second level landing, but the stench was overwhelming. This line, this entire section of, like, how hard it is to get up those stairs, I had such a physical reaction of it because I've been that drunk of just and like feeling so sick and like you may not survive even getting up. And I'm just like happy to be in my 30s and that I don't drink like that because I would not survive.
Yeah.
The next day.
Yeah.
Like, I just think about how bad some of those hangovers were then. I would never make it now.
While you were reading this, I thought about the fact that Bryce probably has nightmares about this night in the future. And right now she's physically unable to climb the stairs because she's drunk and high. But in her nightmare, she's probably unable to climb the stairs because of the emotional pain she knows she's about to cause herself.
Her nightmares are just an endless set of stairs. Ugh. Walking on glass all the time.
And like knowing Danica's gonna be dead at the top.
Yeah, going through like the blood and everything and...
It's pretty bad.
Yeah. We love a good painful scene.
We do. So from a stylistic perspective, I like how the prose changes the second Bryce starts to panic because she realizes there's blood on the door. We start to see shorter, choppier sentences and one-line paragraphs and a lot of M dashes. And to me, they seem like heart palpitations in the actual punctuation.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah. If you look at it visually, it's very interesting.
Yeah.
And did you notice that just before Bryce finds Danica dead, we see that, quote, Bryce's bedroom door was destroyed, the threshold painted in blood, the ballet posters hung in ribbons. Now, if you've listened to our seasons where we cover Court of Thorns and Roses, then you know how important thresholds are in writing. When a character crosses a threshold, they are symbolically crossing into a new state of being or thinking. Here, the threshold is covered in blood, and on the other side, Bryce's world gets turned upside down by the fact that the most important person in the world to her has been brutally killed. I think it's equally important that the ballet posters are in ribbons. After this night, Bryce becomes a completely different person, and that includes her love for dancing. She cannot access that for a long time afterward, and that change is reflected in the destroyed ballet posters.
Yeah. I love those, that imagery.
I do too.
I want to get into how the bodies are positioned. Like, let's first talk about Danica's in Bryce's bed and in her room.
It's an odd choice.
Because, yeah, like, well, to me that shows, like, Bryce was clearly, like, the last person that she had on her mind. But also, like, you don't need to go die on her bed.
Yeah, it's especially cruel.
It's rude.
Yeah.
I'd expect better from either one of us.
Yeah.
Fair. To not die on their bed.
Yeah.
You know, there's that. But it also just makes it hurt so much more, right? Because it just feels so personal now, like it's on her bed. And then at the foot of the bed is Connor, right? As if he was there to protect Danica. And then to the right of Danica is Thorn, the guy who was in love with her. And it just gives me almost like a Christian Renaissance painting vibe. Like, Jesus dying with his disciples.
Oh, okay, okay.
And I know the disciples don't die, but it gives me... We're going to get into a lot of religious context later. We already started with her names, meaning morning star, and she has her pack, her disciples, in many ways. Yeah. And it just, like, I can almost... I know they're described as, like, pieces, but if you look at, like, Renaissance paintings of Jesus's death, he's kind of, like... Very grandiosely, like, spread out on, you know, laying down. And that's kind of how I imagine it.
Yeah. Well, I can see how, like, if we're going to stick with that theme, like, Connor is Peter, the head of the disciples, and Thorne is like Mary Magdalene.
Yeah.
The lover.
Yeah.
So
my question is, who's Judas?
We see another change in the style of writing at this point. Now, things feel like we're watching a horror movie. And this is goes back to what we were talking about earlier, Jack. Quote, "The apartment warped, shrinking and expanding as if it were breathing, the floors rising with each inhale. The, quote, faces of the people on the street blurred and stretched, twisting their horror into something grotesque, something strange and primordial. Like a horror film, there's a lot of descriptions that convey physical damage in gory ways that feels very horror-esque to me. Bryce, quote, knew in her bones that what bled out inside her chest was her heart. Danica lay there in pieces. Quote, her breath tore apart her lungs. Ultimately, her leg is going to get torn open as well. So, it's just a horror film to me.
It's a horror film, and it's also beautifully done.
Yeah.
Like, SJM, her writing is really standing out to me here. I mean, from the get-go, her writing is really good. And you can tell that this is her third series.
Yeah.
Because of just how well thought out everything is. Mm-hmm. And even this line sticks out to me because of just how visual it is. Quote, every logical thought was a ribbon floating above her head. She read them as if following a stalker ticker mounted on a building side. And you can just see that so clearly, where she's not just, is that like a great visual, but you can see how much she's disassociated from herself and her situation.
Yeah.
She is no longer Bryce Quinlan. She is no longer a human or a veneer. Like, she is someone else. That is someone else's problems. She is just a woman running.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, she's not even that. She's a metaphysical being outside of a body, watching the body run.
Yep. Yep.
The whole sequence of Bryce chasing after the demon feels like a reflection of what we'll see in the final battle sequence of this book when she's fighting demons in the city. Especially as she's running, jumping, sliding over cars, quote, fast like Randall had taught her, brutal like he'd made her learn to be. We're going to see that brutality again at the end of the book, as I said, and the mention of Randall here just makes me think of Bryce carrying a gun later, and I had to point it out because it's a parallel that we're going to see.
Yeah. It also shows like the idea that, before I go into my note, but the idea that at this point in her life, the only being that has made her feel strong is a human.
Yeah. It's ironic.
Yeah. It's interesting. It makes sense, though. But this scene also shows her human body and how it keeps going, and that her body, quote, did not fail her. This human body, this body that's too wrong to dance, it's strong and it's getting her through this night. She has shredded feet, which is like so ew. Like the other day I broke glass in the kitchen and then I was reading this.
Yeah.
And I was like, no,
no,
not me. And it's just like everything about it is a way of saying it's just a shame that she doesn't view how strong her body is in this moment.
Yeah. I want to remind the listener that it's important we see Bryce choosing to help the dying angel instead of chasing after the demon. Life would be, it's like one of those memes. If Bryce had chosen to continue to chase after the demon instead of helping the angel, Micah, the book would be done.
Yeah. like, all right, well, that's done now.
Yeah, exactly.
Hunt's free and
cut to credits.
Yeah.
But instead, Bryce chooses to help the dying angel. And this tells me at Bryce's core, she will always choose to help the helpless. Something we see here, something we're going to see many, many times in this novel. Although this, I think, is really the first time. Bryce isn't just a party girl. She's not just the trained daughter of a sharpshooter, and she's not just a willful 23-year-old. She has a bleeding heart, and that's an important trait that we will see here that will influence all her decisions in the future, but is particularly ironic right before we go into chapter 6, told from Isaiah's point of view.
Yeah.
Because everybody views Bryce very differently in that chapter.
Even though Hunt and Isaiah, but like Hunt really notices it the most, where it's like, her rap sheet is one.
Yeah.
Probably because of Danica somehow.
Probably.
Bryce is a good person.
Yeah.
She's, you know, safe. She did some drugs tonight. Drugs does not make someone a bad person. Like,
right.
I personally would not have done that.
Right.
But, like, you're not a bad, is that call her a human? Half human for doing that. Also, quote, she sobbed then as the angel's lip finger brushed against her torn knee as if in comfort. And it's like, SJM, you are just fucking with us.
Constantly. She wrote a book and was like, how can I mess with my reader's mind the most?
It's just so big to hurt me so much.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That's the only reason why it's so big. Is just to fuck with us.
Yeah, it really is. It,
like, already episode 2, and I'm like, this might be her greatest work yet. Skill and tactic-wise.
Before we go into chapter 6, I want to point out the phone number, Micah's phone number specifically. By the way, as readers, the first-time readers, we don't know this is Micah. But mm-hmm. as people who've read it before, we know this is Micah.
Mm-hmm.
His phone number sequence and how it's broken up, I believe in my heart of hearts it's important, but I cannot decipher it. And it's going to drive me up the wall.
Do you think the numbers are what's important in the order? Or
yeah, I think so. Just because even in this episode, I'm going to go more into like the numbers, significance yeah. of numbers. So I'm like, why did you spell out the phone number for us? 1120305.
Did you memorize 77?
Yes.
Did you memorize it?
I did. I need to know, Sarah.
Wow.
Chapter 6 opens with Isaiah Tiberian's point of view. From my best recollection, this is maybe one of two times that we get Isaiah's point of view. And why would SJM choose to write this scene from his perspective?
I think that it has to be through his perspective. Otherwise, we would get too many clues that Hunt is Bryce's mate.
Mm.
You know, already when you have knowledge that they're mates, and as SJM confirmed in her September 2023 interview, they are mates.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes super clear he's yeah. protective of her. And I think if we got it from his point of view, you get lines like Hunt felt more protective of her than he had of anyone before,
mm-hmm.
or like the idea of her with another man made him want to kill or crush something.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
those like typical lines, which I would eat up, but you know, we're going to get so many of these moments, and even later, like, we see him, like, he's the only one who's able to calm her down. He's, you know, they're able to interact with each other. And later on in the upcoming chapters, when Bryce and Hunt reunite, they're both going to be on their guard, right? Like, they're fighting any natural instincts that's there. And right now, it's pure instinct for Hunt and Bryce. And Hunt is the one who has more understanding of that. And, you know, it has to be through Isaiah's. Plus, I think, I don't know, Isaiah kind of pisses me off too. So I get into more sexism bullshit.
Okay, I look forward to it.
But I think I answered. I think I did a good.
I think
I'm proud of my answer.
You did a fabulous. You did a fabulous job.
Thank you.
You did a fabulous job.
Thank you.
It's curious to me that the first time Hunt Athalar enters the scene, this is Isaiah's reaction. Hunt was, quote, an angel who reason and history reminded Isaiah was an ally, though every instinct roared the opposite. Predator, killer, monster. So this thought sequence is coming from the guy that has been friends with Hunt for over 200 years. And we never really see him, quote unquote, frightened of Hunt in the future. I think, to some extent, SJM does this just for the sake of Hunt's introduction and not because Isaiah really feels this.
Yeah, I think it's definitely for the introduction. I do think it's for a little bit of, like, that's how powerful Hunt is, that his friends always have that instinct.
Mm-hmm.
But it also kind of made me feel like, as I'm rereading this, I'm like, do we not trust Isaiah? Should we not trust him? Is this an earlier thing that SJM is telling us? Like,
interesting.
Every time he views Hunt, he views him like a prey would.
Yeah. Yeah.
Rather than an ally.
Because they're not allies, mm-hmm. maybe at the end of the day. Maybe.
I'm just saying, she has a lot of things in your face right now.
She does. Yeah, I mean, I hope so, because this moment always takes me out of the writing.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope it's with a purpose.
Yeah, other than just
like, other than introducing Hunt.
Yeah.
We also casually learn that Hunt has tan skin, while Isaiah has dark brown skin, specifically, quote, dark brown fingers. And I never noticed Same. Isaiah. And at some point, there's a mention of Isaiah having tight brown curls. And I'm like, oh, he's black.
Yeah.
But it's so in passing, and it only gets mentioned once.
Yeah.
And how am I supposed to remember this when this book is almost 1,000 pages?
Yeah, it's...
Yeah, so I have to pause our regularly programmed conversation to have a brief discussion about representation here, which we know is a common concern in the SJM community. So I guess there's representation, but do we know there's representation?
It's such a, like, I totally missed it too. And also it kind of feels like everyone at this point is tan.
Yeah.
Right, you know what I mean? It's like, true. Like everyone's tan.
Everyone's tan.
I'm over here like, what are you guys doing that I'm not doing? Like,
yeah,
what's happening?
It does occur to me as I was thinking about representation and the many layers in this novel that maybe it's just too difficult to create prejudices, not only between species, so humans and Vanir, and then even within the Vanir, angels versus fae. But then we also have the hierarchies of power in each of these, royals versus non-royals, archangels versus non-archangels. You can't also add skin color because it just would be too confusing. I mean, it's realistic. That's how the real world operates. But I think from a writing perspective, you kind of have to pick your battles.
And she chose
which
one to do. And like, and I totally understand SJM wanting to create a world where your skin isn't what's biased, right? It's what kind of veneer you are or not are. And to your point, it would be a lot of layers to add to it. This is going to be my question to the listeners. Is mentioning Isaiah's skin tone and his hair texture one time enough? And if the answer is no, then like, how do we add it to make sense? Because when you have SJM talking about Bryce's skin, Hunt's skin, there's reasons to it. Like, she's doing it because we're trying to hint to the Autumn King, right? That she's the Autumn King's daughter.
Right.
When we hint to Hunt's skin, I think that's more second book where his origin is from, right?
Right.
So, like, I get there's, like, that fine line to dance with where it's like, okay, well, she's talking about their skin tones because it means something. And she has a – so, like, how do you do that in a way where you incorporate it for everyone, but it's not, like, just a careless throwing it out there, but at the same time, you're doing something with your vision here. So it's just more of, like, I have no answers for this. This is, like, as a writer, I don't know what the right answer is to that. Like, I understand representation is so important, you know, and, like, have more main characters that have that representation. And, you know, that's a great way of handling things. But I am curious to see what our listeners think about this, because that is a point of contention that we have heard from listeners. And here is SJM trying, and we've just laid out some of the reasons why she may or may not. So I want to hear from you guys.
I just think, why wasn't Hunt the one with the dark skin and the tight brown curls?
Because, and this is going to book two spoilers, multiverse spoilers. So, I mean, if you guys should have read both by now, but, and this has been recorded before book three has come out, so we don't know. But personally, and people are probably laughing at this, but personally, I think that, like, Hunt is kind of related to the Illyrians.
Right.
And so his skin tone is being talked about, but it can't be different than an Illyrian skin tone. It's all around confusing.
Yeah.
And I can see what she's doing. And yeah, let us know, guys. Thank you for listening to part one of this week's episode of Book Talk for Book Talk. We encourage you to rate and subscribe to our show on your preferred podcast listening platform. Tune in Thursday for part two, where we finish covering this week's chapters.
We would love to hear your thoughts based on today's conversation. You can submit your comments to our form at booktalkforbooktalk.com for a chance to have your feedback discussed during a future mini episode.
If you're enjoying the podcast, please visit our website, booktalkforbooktalk.com, to view our latest merch and learn about supporting the show through Patreon, Ko-Fi, or Venmo.
Bye!